Part 2. Guard of Hades. Chapter 21. July 25th, 2003. Nuku'alofa, Tonga. Under orders from Admiral Sandecker, Captain Birch steered a course straight to the port city of Nuku'alofa, the capital town of the island nation of Tonga, the only remaining Polynesian monarchy. A car was waiting for Pitt and Giordino to rush them to the international airport at Fua'amotu, where they could immediately board a Royal Tongan airliner for Hawaii. From there, a Numa jet would take them on to Washington. Fond and tearful farewells were said with the men and women from the deep encounter. Despite their hair-raising ordeal, almost all of them had voted to return to station and continue their deep ocean survey of the Tonga Trench. Misty cried, Giordino kept blowing his nose, Pitt's eyes were moist, even Birch and House looked as if they had lost their family dog. It was all Pitt and Giordino could do to break away and jump in the waiting car. After boarding a 747, they just had time to settle in their seats and fasten their seatbelts before the big jet was thundering down the runway and rising in a lazy climb. The lush green landscape of Tonga quickly vanished behind them, and then they were climbing over an indigo sea above scattered clouds that looked thick enough to walk on. 30 minutes into the flight, Giordino had drifted off to sleep in the aisle seat. Sitting by the window, Pitt retrieved Egan's leather case from the floor beneath the seat ahead of him and flicked open the clasps. He lifted the lid carefully, leery that it might be filled with oil again. A ridiculous idea, he thought with amusement. There was nothing magical about a prankster doing the deed. The case was empty except for a towel and the cassettes containing the video taken of the Emerald Dolphin by the cameras of the Abyss Navigator. He gently unwrapped the towel until he held the strange-looking, misshapen object with the greenish tint they had picked up from the chapel floor. He turned it over in his left hand, using the fingers of his right. This was the first opportunity he'd had to eye it up close. There was a strange kind of greasy feel about it. Instead of being jagged and coarse, like most badly incinerated inorganic material, the object was rounded and smooth and twisted in a spiral. Pitt didn't have a clue as to its composition. He rewrapped the object in the towel and set it back in the case. He was certain the chemists in the Numa lab would identify it. Once he delivered the material, his part of the mystery was finished. Breakfast came, but he begged off and had only tomato juice and coffee. Hunger eluded him. As he sipped the coffee, he again stared out the window. An island was drifting under the aircraft far below, an emerald speck set on a blue topaz sea. He studied it for a moment and recognized the shape as Tutuila, one of the American Samoan islands. He could make out the harbor of Pago Pago, where he'd visited the naval station many years ago with his father, then a United States congressman on a junket around the Pacific. He recalled the trip well. He was a boy in his middle teens, and he'd taken every opportunity to dive around the island while his father was inspecting the naval facilities, gliding among the coral and the brilliantly colored fish with a spear gun. He'd rarely released the old surgical rubber sling, sending the thin spear shaft at a fish. He'd preferred simply to study or photograph the wonders beneath the surface. After a day spent enjoying the water, he would relax on the sandy beach under a palm tree and contemplate his future. And then he remembered another beach, this one on the island of Oahu in Hawaii. He was still in the Air Force then. He saw himself as a young man with the woman whose memory had never left him. Summer Moran was the loveliest woman he'd ever known. He could recall in vivid detail the first time they'd met in the bar at the Ala Moana Hotel on Waikiki Beach. Her enchanting gray eyes, the long, fiery red hair, the perfectly shaped body in a tight oriental silk green dress slit on the sides. Then came the vision of her death, as it had 1,000 times. He'd lost her during an earthquake in an underwater city built by her mad father, Frederick Moran. She'd swum down to save him and never returned. He closed down that part of the memory as he had done so often in the past and stared at his reflection in the window. The eyes still radiated an intensity that had never dimmed, and yet There was a slight hint of age and weariness creeping into them. He wondered what it would be like to meet himself as he was 20 years ago. Suppose the young Dirk Pitt of 2 decades ago walked up and sat down next to him on a park bench. How would he receive the fresh young buck who had served with distinction as an Air Force pilot? Would he even recognize him? How would the youth see the old Dirk Pitt? Could he remotely foresee the wild adventures, agonizing heartbreaks, and bloody encounters and injuries? The old Pitt doubted it. Would the young Pitt be repulsed at what he saw and shy away from what lay ahead, taking a totally different direction in their lives? Pitt turned back from the window, closed his eyes, and put the vision of his youth and what might have been out of his mind. Would he do it all over again if given the chance for a restart? For the most part, the answer was yes. Oh, sure, he would have made a few alterations and fine-tuned different episodes of his life, but on the whole, it had been extremely satisfying and filled with achievement. He felt thankful simply to be alive and let it go at that. His thoughts were interrupted by the bouncing of the plane as it hit turbulence. He complied when the fasten-your-seatbelt light gonged on. He stayed awake and read magazines until the plane landed at the John Rogers International Airport in Honolulu. He and Jordina were met by the pilot from NUMA who was to fly them to Washington. He escorted them to the carousels so they could pick up their luggage and then drove them to a turquoise-painted NUMA Gulfstream jet on the far side of the airport. When they took off, the sun was falling in the western sky and the blue was slowly turning black in the east. For most of the trip, Jordino slept like a zombie, while Pitt fitfully dozed off and on. When he woke, his mind began to work. Was his end of the Emerald Dolphin tragedy finished? There was little doubt that Admiral Sandecker would put him to work on a new project. He made up his mind to argue against that possibility. He decided he had to see the mystery through to its conclusion. Those who had caused the terrible fire of the cruise liner must pay. They had to be tracked down, their motives dissected, and then punished. His mind slowly turned from the inhuman unpleasantness to the lure of sleeping in his own down-filled bed in his aircraft hangar apartment. He wondered if Congresswoman Lauren Smith, his current lady love, would meet him after the plane landed, as she did so often. Lauren, with her cinnamon hair and violet eyes. They had come so close to marriage on several occasions, but never quite got over the hump. Maybe now was the time. God only knows, thought Pitt. I can't be bounding all over the oceans and falling in a pit of devilment for many more years. Age, he knew, was creeping over his body like a layer of molasses, slowing it down infinitesimally until one day he would wake up and say, "My God, I'm eligible for Social Security and Medicare." "No," he said aloud. Jordino awoke and looked at him. "Did you call?" Pitt smiled. "I'm talking in my sleep." Jordino shrugged, rolled to his side, and re-entered dreamland. "No," Pitt thought silently this time. "I'm not going out to pasture. Not for a long while yet. There would always be another undersea project, another maritime investigation. There was no way he would quit until they closed the lid on his casket." When he woke up for the final time, the aircraft was touching down at Langley Air Force Base. The day was dark and rainy, the water streaking across the windows. The pilot taxied to the NUMA terminal and stopped just short of an open hangar. When Pitt stepped to the asphalt, he paused and looked toward the nearby parking lot. His hopes were in vain. Lauren Smith was not there to greet him. Jordino went to his condo in Alexandria to clean up and call a bevy of his girlfriends to let them know he was back in circulation. Pitt postponed the comforts of home and took a NUMA Jeep to the NUMA headquarters on the East Hill overlooking the Potomac River. He parked the Jeep in the underground parking lot and took the elevator up to the 10th floor, the domain of Hiram Yeager, the agency's computer genius, who headed up a vast network. Jaeger's library contained every known scientific fact or historical event about the oceans since recorded history, and then some. Jaeger came out of Silicon Valley and had been with NUMA almost 15 years. He looked like an old hippie, with his graying hair tied in a ponytail. His standard uniform for the day was a pair of Levi's, a Levi jacket, and cowboy boots. Nobody knew it to look at him, but he lived in an elegantly designed house in a fashionable residential section of Maryland. He drove a BMW 740 IL, and his daughters were honor students and equestrian trophy winners. He'd also created and designed a technically advanced computer named Max that was nearly human. He'd programmed photos of his wife into the holographic image that appeared when he talked to it. Jaeger was studying the latest results sent from a NUMA expedition off Japan that was drilling into the seafloor in a search for life under the silt and the fractured rock when Pitt walked into his sanctum sanctorum. He looked up, then stood and smiled as he extended his hand. "Well, well, the scourge of the dismal deep is home again." He was taken aback at Pitt's appearance. The NUMA special projects director looked like a lost soul off the street. His shorts and flowered shirt were ratty, and he was wearing slippers over heavily bandaged feet. Despite several hours of sleep on the airplanes, his eyes looked tired and washed out. His face had over a week's growth of scraggly beard. This was clearly a man who had seen hard times. "For the man of the hour, you look like second-class roadkill." Pitt shook Jaeger's hand. "I came directly from the airport just to harass you." "I don't doubt it for a moment." He looked into Pitt's eyes with pure admiration. "I read the report about the incredible rescue performed by you and the Deep Encounters crew, followed up by your fight with the pirates. How do you become involved in so much havoc?" "It finds me," said Pitt, throwing up his hands in a modest gesture. "Seriously, the lion's share of the credit goes to the entire complement of the research ship, who worked like fiends in saving the passengers. And Giardino did most of the work in rescuing the crew of the survey ship." Jaeger well knew Pitt's aversion to words of praise and compliments. The guy was too self-conscious for his own good, Jaeger thought. He skipped over any more talk of the recent events and motioned for Pitt to sit down. "Have you seen the Admiral yet? He has about 50 media interviews lined up for you." "I'm not ready to face the world just yet. I'll see him in the morning." "What brings you to my world of electronic manipulation?" Pitt laid Egan's leather case on Jaeger's desk and opened it. He unwrapped the object taken from the cruise liner and handed it to him. "I'd like to have this analyzed and identified." Jaeger examined the odd-shaped thing for a moment, then nodded. "I'll have the chemistry lab do a number on it. Unless it has a complicated molecular structure, I should have an answer for you in 2 days. Anything else?" Pitt passed over the video cassettes from the Abyss Navigator. "Computer enhance and digitize these into three-dimensional images." "Can do." "One final thing before I head home." He laid a drawing on the desk. "Have you ever seen a company logo like this?" Jaeger examined Pitt's crude drawing of the three-headed dog with a snake for a tail and the word Cerberus beneath. He stared at Pitt queerly. "You don't know what outfit this is?"
"No."
"Where did you see it?"
"It was covered up on the side of the pirate's workboat."
"An oil rig workboat?"
"Yes, the same type," Pitt replied.
"You're familiar with it?"
"I am," replied Jaeger, sagely.
"You're opening a real can of worms if you connect the Cerberus Corporation with the hijacking of the Deep Encounter."
"The Cerberus Corporation," Pitt said, uttering each syllable slowly. "How stupid of me. I should have known. The conglomerate owns most of the U.S. domestic oil fields, copper and iron mines, and its chemical division makes 1,000 different products." "It was the three-headed dog that threw me. I failed to make the connection."
"All very relevant when you think about it.
Why a three-headed dog as a corporate logo?" Each head stands for a division of the company, answered Jaeger. One for oil, one for mining, and the other for the chemistry division. And the serpent's tail? Asked Pitt, half facetiously. Does that represent something dark and sinister? Jaeger shrugged. Who can say? What's the source for the dog? Cerberus. Sounds Greek. Jaeger sat at his computer and typed on the keyboard. In a chamber just opposite his console, the face and figure of an attractive woman appeared in three dimensions. She was dressed in a one-piece bathing suit. You called? She said. Hello, Max. You know Dirk Pitt. The hazy brown eyes flicked from Pitt's feet to his face. Yes, I am familiar with him. How are you, Mr. Pitt? Fair to middling, as they say in Oklahoma. And you, Max, how are you? The face changed to an angry pout. The stupid bathing suit Hiram put on me, it doesn't flatter me at all. Would you prefer something else? Asked Jaeger. An elegant Armani suit, Andra Gabrielle lingerie, and high heel ankle strap sandals by Tons would be nice. Jaeger smiled, a cocky smile. What color? Red, Max replied without hesitation. Jaeger's fingers flew in a blur over the computer keyboard. Then he sat back to admire his handiwork. Max faded for a few moments and then reappeared in an elegant red suit with blouse, jacket, and skirt. Much better, she said happily. I hate to look mundane when I'm on the job. Now that you're in a good mood, I would like you to produce data on the subject. Max ran her hands over her new outfit. Just name it. What can you tell me about Cerberus, the three-headed dog? From Greek mythology, Max came back instantly. Hercules, Latin for Heracles, as the Greeks called him, in a fit of temporary insanity murdered his own wife and children. The god Apollo ordered him to serve King Eurystheus of Mycenae for 12 years as punishment for his terrible act. As part of his sentence, Hercules had to perform 12 labors, feats so challenging they looked impossible. He had to overcome all sorts of hideous monsters, the most difficult being the submission of Cerberus, again Latin for the Greek Kerberos. This was the three-headed, grotesque dog who guarded the gates of Hades and prevented the dead souls from escaping from the underworld. The three heads represented the past, present, and future. What the serpent tail signified is not known to me. Did Hercules destroy the dog? Asked Pitt. Max shook her head. Near the gates of the Acheron River, one of 5 running into the underworld, he wrestled the monstrosity into submission after being bitten, not by the dog's jaws, but by the serpent on the tail. Hercules then took Cerberus to Mycenae and showed him off before returning him to Hades. That's about it in a nutshell, except that Cerberus's sister was Medusa, the hussy with snakes for hair. What can you tell me about the Cerberus Corporation? Which one? There must be a dozen businesses around the world that go under the name Cerberus. A widely diversified corporation that does business in oil, mining, and chemistry. Oh, that one, said Max, enlightened. Have you got about 10 hours? You have that much data on Cerberus? Pitt asked, constantly amazed at Max's enormous library of information. Not yet. But I will after I've entered their network and those of the companies who do business with them. Since their interests are international, various world governments also must have extensive files on them. Pitt looked at Jaeger suspiciously. Since when is hacking into corporate networks legal? Jaeger's expression took on that of a canny fox. Once I give Max a command to search, far be it from me to interfere with their methods. Pitt rose from his chair. I'll leave it to you and Max to come up with the answers. We'll get to work on it. Pitt turned and gazed at Max. So long for now, Max. You look stunning in that outfit. Thank you, Mr. Pitt. I like you. A pity our circuits can't integrate. Pitt approached Max and extended his hand. It went through the image. You never know, Max. Someday Hiram may be able to make you solid. I hope so, Mr. Pitt, said Max in a husky voice. Oh, how I hope so. The old aircraft hangar, built in the 1930s for a long-since defunct airline, stood off in one corner of Ronald Reagan International Airport. The corrugated metal walls and roof were coated with orange-brown rust. Its few windows were boarded over, and the door to what once had been the office was weather-worn, with fading and peeling paint. The rounded roof structure sat at the end of an airport maintenance dirt road not far from a guard gate. Pitt parked the Numa Jeep in the weeds outside the hangar and paused at the entrance door. He glanced at the security camera atop a wooden pole on the other side of the road to see that it had stopped its swivel and was aimed directly at him. Then he punched a sequence of numbers, waited for a series of clicks inside the hangar, and turned the brass latch. The ancient door swung open noiselessly. The interior was dark except for a few skylights above an upstairs apartment. He switched on the lights. The sudden effect was dazzling. Set off in their most elegant magnificence by the bright overhead lights, white walls, and epoxy floor, were three rows of beautifully restored classic automobiles. Sitting incongruously at the end of one row, but just as dazzling as the others, was a 1936 Ford Hot Rod. On one side of the hangar sat a World War II German jet fighter and a 1929 tri-motor transport. Beyond was a turn-of-the-century railroad Pullman car, an odd-looking sailboat mounted on a rubber raft, and a bathtub with an outboard motor attached on one end. The collection of automotive mechanical masterpieces of art represented events in Pitt's life. They were relics of his personal history. They were cherished, maintained by him, and seen by only his closest friends. No one driving the Mount Vernon Memorial Highway past Ronald Reagan Airport, who glanced at the obsolete aircraft hangar across the end of the runways, could have imagined the incredible array of breathtaking artifacts inside. Pitt closed and locked the door. He took a brief tour, as he always did after returning home after an expedition. Several rainstorms in the past month had kept down the dust. Tomorrow, he told himself, he would run a soft cloth over the gleaming paint and remove what light coating of dust that had seeped inside the hangar while he was gone. Finishing his inspection, he climbed the antique iron circular staircase to his apartment that was perched above the main floor against the hangar's far wall. The interior of his apartment was just as unique as the eclectic transportation collection below. Here there were all sorts of nautical antiques. No self-respecting interior decorator would have set foot in the place, certainly none who endorsed clutter. The 1,100 square feet of living space that included the living room, bathroom, kitchen, and a bedroom were crowded with objects from old ships, sunk or scrapped. There was a large wooden-spoked helm from an ancient clipper ship, a compass binnacle from an old Orient tramp steamer, ship's bells, brass and copper divers' helmets. The furniture was an assemblage of antique pieces that came from ships that had sailed the seas in the 19th century. Ship models in glass cases sat on low shelves, while marine paintings of ships crossing the seas by the respected artist Richard de Rosset hung on the walls. After taking a shower and shaving, he made reservations at a small French restaurant that was only a mile from the hangar. He could have called Lauren, but decided he wished to dine alone. Relationships could come later, once he'd wound down. An enjoyable dinner alone, and then a night in his large goose-down mattress bed would serve to rejuvenate him to face the next day. After dressing, he had 20 minutes to kill before leaving for the restaurant. He took the slip of paper with Kelly's phone number on it and called her. After 5 rings, he was about to hang up, wondering why her voicemail didn't come on, when she finally answered. Hello? Hello, Kelly Egan. He could hear the intake of breath over the line. Dirk, you're back. Just got in and thought I'd call. I'm so glad you did. I'm due for a few days vacation. How busy are you? Up to my ears in charity work, she answered. I'm chairman for the local handicapped children's organization. We're putting on our annual children's flying roundup, and I'm chairman of the event. I hate to sound stupid, but what is a flying roundup? Kelly laughed. It's like an air show. People fly in old vintage airplanes and take the kids for rides in them. You have your work cut out for you. Tell me about it, she said with a quaint laugh. The man who owned a 60-year-old Douglas DC-3 was scheduled to take the kids on flights over Manhattan, but he had a problem with the landing gear and can't make the show. Where is the roundup? Just across the Hudson River in New Jersey, at a private field near a town called Englewood Cliffs. It's not far from Dad's farm and laboratory. The voice seemed to sadden. Pitt walked out onto the balcony of his apartment with the portable phone and gazed at the classics below. His eyes fell on the big three-engine transport plane from 1929. I think I can help you out on your aerial sightseeing project. You can? Kelly asked, brightening up again. You know where you can get an old transport plane? When is the roundup? 2 days from now. How can you arrange for one on such short notice? Pitt smiled to himself. I know somebody who is an easy touch for beautiful women and handicapped kids.